find Mark 8 and then keep your place. And once you have Mark 9, turn back to Matthew chapter 6. And in verse 9, we have the beginning of what has come to be known as the Lord's Prayer. And, you know, every Bible version translates this differently, and there's some of us know it with the thys and thous, and some of us know it with the yours and his and all that. But let's read this together. I'm reading from the New King James, and this is the one that Jesus had. Or so I'm told. I really don't know. Okay. In this manner, therefore, pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Every time we read, think, or pray those words, the phrase, your kingdom come, passes through our lips and through our thoughts. But what would you do, or what will you do, when the kingdom comes? Have you thought about that? We pray, Lord, you know, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth, just like it is in heaven. Lord, we can't wait for that day when they beat their, you know, swords into plows. But then when it happens, are you going to be ready? What are you going to do? Let's review a little bit here. Over the last few chapters, Mark, you know, continues to build to this climax. He started with this little snowball, then he kind of pitched it down the hill, and now it's been going and going, and actually he doesn't really stop till we get to the chapter 10, but now it's getting pretty big, it's really rolling. And we've seen a lot of stuff as Mark is revealing the kingdom to us. We've seen Jesus healed the sick, you know, again and again and again, to show us, to reveal that in the kingdom, there is no sickness. He's the healer, and in the kingdom, there's no sickness. Jesus fed the crowds, not once, but twice, we've read so far in Mark, to show that he is the bread of heaven, and that in the kingdom, there is no hunger. He walked on water to reveal that not only does he have that kind of authority and power over the natural elements and things like gravity and mass and, you know, quantum physics, looking ahead to our time with Missler, but also to show that in the kingdom of God, there is no danger. There are no obstacles. You need to get to the other side of the lake? Don't worry about the water. You need to get to the other side of the world? You don't worry about the water. You don't need an airplane. You know, he showed us what the kingdom is like. And now, as the kingdom gets clearer and clearer, as the kingdom gets closer and closer, he continues to reveal the kingdom in the passages that we're going to look at here this morning, starting in Mark. And the first thing we see this. Well, in the last five verses of Mark chapter 8 are about becoming a part of God's kingdom. Let's read those, starting in verse 34. When he'd called the people to himself, with his disciples also, he said to them, "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." We're talking about becoming a part of God's kingdom. Notice, first of all, the invitation's open to everyone. Verse 34, when he had called the people to himself, with his disciples. This wasn't just for that inner circle, just for the 12. It wasn't just for that 100 or so hangers-on in the sort of the larger, you know, entourage. He called the people, the multitude, whoever happened to be around. Jesus kind of said, hey, everybody, you know, come on in. I got something I want to say. The invitation's open to everybody. He says real clearly in this next, in the words in red, whoever desires to come after me. Whoever desires, anyone that desires it. And then he moves on. The invitation's open to anyone, but, and the requirements that he spells out here are for everyone. Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Now it hasn't been that long, and this is kind of convoluted, so follow me here. As we studied through 1 Corinthians last year, right before we got to chapter 3, we took a little side trip from Corinthians 3 over to Luke chapter 14, and we talked about this idea of discipleship in depth. And rather than repeat all that same information, it would have been easy for me. I could have just whipped out the old sermon and, you know, read the notes, but that's not, I don't think, kosher, is that the word? I don't think the Lord likes reruns and repeats. So I'm going to refer you to get the tape or listen to it on the internet. All that stuff is there. It's in the 1 Corinthians series, but it's actually a study on Luke 14 where Jesus says the same thing. If you want to follow me, you deny yourself, take up your cross, and it's a kind of a larger, expanded passage. But just for the sake of review, let's talk about these 3 points in kind of a brief way. First thing I notice is when he says, whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross. Now, if you back up a little in chapter 8, this is where Jesus has announced to his people, the Son of Man must go to Jerusalem, be handed over to the scribes and priests, be killed, and on the third day, rise again. They didn't understand it. They didn't get it. But he had shared that information with them. And so, and he says, you deny yourself the way I'm denying myself, and you take up your cross the way I'm just about here in a little while to take up my cross. I think there's significance there. Now let's talk about what he means. When he says, you must deny yourself. Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself. What he means there briefly is to abandon your personal agenda. You know, I was just had an email this morning, as a matter of fact, from a kid that I grew up with. We were always friends. We were two little fat kids that knew how to play guitar. And so we bonded when we were about, 10 or something. Craig. And Craig moved to Nashville a long time ago. He was the band leader for a guy you might have heard of named Colin Ray. Bubba, we call him. And Craig was the band leader and wrote a couple songs that Bubba recorded. And then after a while, he got tired. He had some back problems and had to get off the road. So he hasn't been with him for, 5 or 6 years now, or maybe a little longer. But anyway, Craig, as we both did during our early years and preteen and teen years and into early adulthood, followed that career path of being a full-time professional musician and recording and touring and so forth and all that. And, you've heard my testimony, how I hit the skids. And Craig's story is a lot like that. He achieved a little more success in the musical world than I did. But he also crashed, a little harder and burned a little brighter, if I can use that word, burned darker. He dug even a deeper hole than I did. And a couple years ago, Craig found himself down in that hole where he was kind of all by himself with a drug habit. He had a drug habit, no longer had a wife and family, saying, is this really what I wanted? Was this my career goal, my life's dream, to sit here in this cheesy little flea bag apartment in Nashville with no wife, no job, a closet full of guitars, and no future? And of course the answer is no. And I won't tell you all the details, but Craig ultimately surrendered his life to the Lord and is walking with the Lord now for a year or a little over a year. He's still wet behind the ears, you know, but it's fun. He's so excited about it. He emailed me this morning and he was talking about, you know, the life that he lived and the life that I lived too for a long time about, you know, reaching for that brass ring of success. And then finally you get it and you go, well, this is tinfoil, you know, and it bends and it breaks and it doesn't last. And you know, the dream wasn't anything like the reality. And we go through lives with our own agenda. I'm going to be a success, you know, in this career field. Or I'm going to be a success with, you know, in relationships. I'm going to have, you know, this kind of family and this kind of husband or this kind of wife. And I'm going to have this kind of job and I'm going to have this kind of car or cars. And I'm going to have, you know, this house and I'm going to have that boat and that jet ski and this, you know, snowboard and I'm going to vacation, you know, and I'm going to, and we have this whole agenda that we've mapped out for ourselves. And even if, you know, in some cases you're just kind of going with the flow, bouncing from one thing to the next. But even then there's always this hope. There's this dream. This is what I want to reach, you know, and then when I get there, I'll be able to go, I've made it. That's our agenda. And see, Jesus says, if you want to follow me, if your desire is to come after me, the first thing you do is you abandon that agenda. Whatever it was that you thought was going to bring you peace, love, joy, happiness, security, fulfillment, whatever you thought it was that was going to make your life okay and worth living and glad to be alive, he said, number one, you got to let that go. Deny yourself. Then he talks about you must take up your cross. Now, what in the heck does he mean by that? Lots of theories on that. And again, it's something I talked about, I think, at length in the other study. And I don't want to just repeat everything, but the cross for Jesus and for everyone that was there that heard him say that was clearly understood as a symbol of death. You know, when Jesus was just a little boy, there was a rebellion against the Roman government up in Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. And the Romans came in hard and heavy and put that rebellion down. And then they lined both sides of the road to Nazareth for I don't know how many miles with the crucified bodies of the rebels. That had to have made quite an impression on little boy Jesus. He understood what the cross was all about, not only for him, but for everybody else. And so when he said, take up your cross, there's no question that everybody within earshot understood that he was talking about death. Death to what, though? That's kind of the question. Take up your cross, you know, the way I'm going to take up my cross. We take up our cross, it means that we die, first of all, to the demands of the flesh. And we could go to all kinds of Paul's letters where he talks about take off the old man and put on the new man and, you know, alive, you know, dead to sin, alive to God. But, you know, again, that's in the other study and I don't want to repeat it all. But to take up your cross means to die to the demands of the flesh. What that means is to die to the belief that if I just get what I want, then I'll be satisfied. It's kind of like, you know, you're hungry. And you think, if I just eat, you know, 7 Mallow bars, then my life will be worth living and everything will come together for me. You know, what will happen is you'll get sick to your stomach. You know, moon pies or something. You know, whatever it is, the demands of the flesh, the desires of the flesh, you know, physical or emotional needs. He says, take up your cross. You know, die to that stuff. And also die to the false promises of the world or the false promises of society. You know, we are indoctrinated from birth practically, and not only in America, but just life on planet Earth, that if we achieve certain things within what the society we live in, that's going to meet our need for fulfillment and contentment and peace and joy and all those things. And, you know, it doesn't work. And Jesus says, you've got to put all that stuff to death, all those fantasies to death. I had a guy come into my office once when I was working in Vancouver, and he was married and the marriage was in trouble. So if I remember right, they were actually separated. And he was telling me all about, well, you know, the old lady left me and I'm glad she did because I've got this new gal over in, you know, Yakima or something, you know, and down in Newburgh. I've got this other gal and when the divorce is final, we're going to get married and then I'm going to live happily ever after. And I had to break the news to the poor guy. I said, you know, what you're describing to me is a fantasy. You know, yeah, but me and this gal, we're on the internet every night. We talk on the phone for hours. Sorry, pal, but what you've done is you set up in your head a fantasy of what for you is the perfect woman and the perfect partner. And nobody lives up to a fantasy. Because what you're going to, I'm going to see you again here in a year or 5 years, and all this nasty stuff you're saying about the old lady that you just got rid of, you're going to be telling me about her. We set up these fantasies. Jesus, he says, take up your cross. He means put to death those fantasies about how great it's going to be when. You know, to my friend, the guitar player, just how neat it's going to be when you're on the Grand Ole Opry. Been there, done that. It ain't that great. It's just another gig. Yeah, but when you get on the tour bus and the Learjet, and when you fly to Spain and you're playing at the castle and there's 50,000 people out there and you're doing your thing. And then, you know, like what could be better than that? Well, you know what? It's just another gig. It's no different than playing down at the Silver Shores Resort. It's no different. And you learn that the hard way. See, we set up these fantasies. When my company, you know, when I own everything, you know, then no, it's a fantasy. What you do is when you own everything, that means you've got to worry about everything. It's, you know, it doesn't work. He says you got to deny yourself, abandon that personal agenda, take up your cross. You got to die to the demands of the flesh and the false promises of the world. And then he says, follow me. Whoever desires to come after me, deny yourself, take up your cross. Step number three, follow me. Follow him where? Follow him to the cross and beyond. I love to talk about the cross. I love to talk about the fact that my sin is forgiven. The only real problem I have is solved on the cross. The disease that's going to take my life is cured on the cross. I love talking about that. I love thinking about it. But the story doesn't end there. See, there's that's what's that book? It's Friday, but Sunday's coming. See, the cross is huge, but there's the resurrection. That's even huger. You know, it's bigger. It's more. We got to follow him to the cross and into the resurrection. Just like Jesus, you have to die. We have to die so that we can rise. Jesus talked about it. You have to plant the seed before the thing can grow up. Jesus had to die on the cross before he could be resurrected. We have to die to ourselves. We have to die to that old life before the new life can ever come. That's what it's talking about when he says you must be born again. I've been born once physically. You know, I got to put all that flesh and that worldly nature. I got to, you know, walk away from that. I've got to abandon it. I've got to let it die. And then I receive a new life. I'm born again. I'm spirit filled. I'm spirit empowered. I'm not just sealed. And that's a wonderful thing to be sealed and filled and indwelt and all that. But now I'm empowered. I have actually the Spirit of God sort of working on me the way a potter works on clay. A little, you know, well, let's cut that off. You know, that's no good. And let's shape this and mold this and mold and work. And that's what the Spirit does in our lives. But that doesn't happen until you deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow him. You know, but when we do that, when you follow, we're alive in a new way. We get a new purpose. We get new priorities. We get a new perspective on everything. That's what it means to follow Jesus. See, you got to give up your old life to find a new one. Again, verse 34, when he called him, he says, you know, it said, whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For, here's the explanation, whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's, will save it. You know what this is? It's like finders keepers in reverse. We all, finders keepers, losers weepers, na 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 na. You know? But that's the way of the world. But in God's kingdom, it's more like finders weepers, losers keepers. Look at what he's talking about here. I love this. Now, there's I want you to notice in the verse 34, he said, whoever desires to come after me. Okay, we talked about that. And it starts with verse 35, whoever desires to save his life. Talking about two desires there. This word desire can also be translated intends or intention. It's not just want, but it's I intend. Whoever intends to come after me, whoever is intent on saving his life. That's what he's really talking about. See, the desire for God's kingdom is in direct opposition to the desire for the world. The intent to live in the kingdom is the exact opposite of intending to live in the world. And so we all have to ask ourselves, which life do you intend to live? You know, which one do you intend? If you're intent on life apart from Jesus, you will lose. See, the world makes a promise it can't keep. The pleasures of sin turn to poison after a season. And if you continue on that path, you'll find disappointment and death, because that's truly the definition of a dead end. There's no other outcome. But on the other hand, if you surrender that desire, that intention, that is, if you deny yourself and take up your cross and follow him, you'll gain the very thing that you were looking for in the first place. These next couple of verses illustrate that principle. Verse 36, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? You know, gaining the world is kind of like having lots and lots of Monopoly money. I got 10 gazillion dollars in Monopoly money. He says, what good is that? You know, what good is that if you lose your soul, and what will you give for your soul? Because you can't give that. You know, they don't take Monopoly money. You can't try to go to the store. You can't buy anything with Monopoly money. You can't put it in the bank. If you're lucky, they'll laugh at you. If you're not lucky, they'll call the cops and they'll arrest you. It doesn't work. Monopoly money's no good. And compared to the soul, compared to following Jesus, compared to being a part of the kingdom of God, anything the world has to offer is just monopoly money. You know, it might work in the game, but that's all it's good for. If you don't give up the old life, you lose out on a new one. See, there's no other way to save your soul other than giving up the old life, other than denying ourselves, taking up our cross. There's no other way to save our souls, and we don't have anything else to give for it. That's the point he made a minute ago. If you desire, or if you intend, to use that word, to experience the peace and the joy that are part and parcel of being forgiven and accepted by God, there's only one way to do it, and that is to let go of life apart from Jesus and follow him. See, there's no other way to have your sin forgiven. And if your sin hasn't been forgiven, you won't be there when the kingdom comes. Verse 38, for whoever is ashamed of me in my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. See, Jesus doesn't, he gives us the positive. If you want to come after me, if you intend to come after me, deny yourself, take up your cross, you know, die to self, die to the world, all that stuff, and follow me. And he doesn't, You know, he doesn't explain the other side of the coin because it's really not necessary. But what's implied is, and if you don't deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me, if you don't desire to come after me, the result is when the kingdom comes, you won't be there. You won't be part of it. Now that's the last few verses of chapter 8. The first 13 verses of chapter 9 are about getting a peek at God's kingdom. Now notice that 9:1 is a continuation of the same speech. It's just the next sentence, the next breath. This isn't a week later or this is just a continuation. When he ends off in 38, you know, the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father and the holy angels. And he said to them, assuredly, I say to you that there are some standing here, you know, right now, who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God present with power. And now, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up on a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. Here we see Jesus with his inner circle, his core group of believers. You know, there are books and there are seminars on church growth that make a big deal out of this. And I don't want to make a big deal. I don't want to make too much of it. But there is something to be learned, so I don't just want to skip over it either. There's more than one school of thought on this, but here's the way I see it. There are four basic groups of people, briefly. First, there's the community, and it means exactly that. It's the unchurched. We live in the total community. It's everybody, you know, for whatever you consider the borders of the community. That's the community. Then, from the community comes the crowd. That's you, the attenders. From the community come the people who actually attend church. You're the crowd. We are the crowd. Now, within the crowd, there are the committed that are growing and giving, that is, growing in maturity, getting to know the Lord better and better, investing themselves in whatever it takes to accomplish that, to actually take on the nature of Jesus, to develop the fruit of the Spirit and all that. You're growing, you're maturing, and you're giving. You're giving of your time, your treasure, and your talent. That's the committed group. And then, from the committed comes the core, those that are serving, leading, and teaching others. Now, our goal here as a church is to move everyone from the community to the core, you know, because it's those core people that move on to the next community and start the whole thing again. And God's kingdom grows. That's what we're all about, to bring the community into the crowd, to grow the crowd into the committed, and to turn the committed into the core, and then send them out to repeat the process. Jesus is not, notice, excluding the other nine. I mean, that's not the point here. He's investing in these three. He's developing in these three. And there's a pattern there that we do well to follow. Now, Peter, who's an eyewitness to this event, you know, as he tells Mark, Peter describes the scene. They were led up apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His clothes became shining, exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. Now let's remember that they were in the area of Caesarea Philippi, the northern end of Israel, up where the tribe of Dan had their territory. And we talked last week a little bit about the actual location of Caesarea Philippi, the headwaters of the Jordan flowing out of that cave at the bottom of that cliff. Well, that cliff is the beginning of the foothills of Mount Hermon. Now, Mount Hermon is the only mountain in all of Israel that we would call a mountain. You know, like they would call that hill across the street a mountain. And we go, that's not a mountain. That's a hill. But Mount Hermon is a snow-capped peak, you know, that you can't just walk up. I mean, it's a real live mountain, but like our mountain, like most mountains, if not all mountains, there's a series of foothills. And so Jesus took them up there, probably not to the peak of Mount Hermon. That would have been, you know, that would have required like snowshoes and oxygen. You know, it's a mountain. But they walked somewhere up in those foothills and found a high peak. And it says that he was transfigured. It's the Greek word for metamorphosed. Metamorphuo or something like that. But it means metamorphosed, the same way that we talk about caterpillars metamorphose into butterflies and tadpoles metamorphose into frogs. It's not just a change in appearance. It wasn't just that Jesus looked different. There was a metamorphosis here, a transfiguration, a change in his essential nature. This is the same word that Romans 12:2 uses when it says, don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed, be metamorphosed by the renewing of your mind, the washing of water with the word. You know, have the word wash your mind so that you'll be metamorphosed, a change in your essential nature from what you used to be to what you are in the Lord. Not just a change in appearance, not just a change in habits. It's not an outward change so much as it's an inward change. That's what he's talking about here. And what they're seeing here is the spiritual Jesus with that physical tent removed. This is the real Jesus. You know, this is what, but he sort of breaks through the five senses and the dimensions of this physical reality, and they're seeing him in his authentic, genuine spiritual state. In verse 3, his clothes became shining exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. That's the best Peter can do. It's the closest thing to his experience. I mean, he's never seen anything like this. And he's thinking, you know, it's whiter than the best laundry. It's like snow. I mean, what else is he going to compare it to? You know, it's like Ajax laundry detergent is whiter than white. He's going, he's whiter than Ajax. That's all I can say. So he sees this incredible thing. He's a part of it, you know. He's up there with Jesus and he's watching this. And then he realizes Jesus is not alone. Verse 4, and Elijah appeared to them with Moses. And they, that is Moses and Elijah, were talking to Jesus. Moses, of course, the lawgiver who led God's people out of slavery. And Elijah, the prophet who proclaimed God's plan. Moses, Elijah, and Peter. Verse 5, then Peter answered. Now wait a minute. I don't remember anybody asking him any questions. But this word answered, it means responded. It doesn't mean that he just kind of, that, you know, he felt he was part of the discussion apparently. And Peter answered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, you know, three tents, three booths. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, because it says he didn't know what to say. For they were greatly afraid. He didn't know what to say, but he felt like he just had to say something. So even though they weren't talking to him, he responded. It reminds me of the time my sister's boyfriend had this car. It was an old police car. It was some kind of big Ford thing, I don't know where he got it, but it looked like an undercover car or something. It wasn't painted like a police car, but it was a police car, and I was like 11, and he had told me it was a police car, and I'm hanging with him because he's older and he's cool, and he's, you know, and he's trying to sell this car, and a guy comes to look at the car, and he's looking around, oh, what year is it? Oh, you know, whatever, 64 or 67, whatever it was, and what kind of engines it got? I don't know, it's got that. Is that a 427 or a 6439 or, you know, and it's got one dual exhaust and all the features. And I go, yeah, it's an old cop car. And my brother-in-law goes, and gave me a look like, you know, I don't remember asking you, Ronnie, about the car. And the guy didn't buy the car. And apparently there was something about it being a cop car that was not, you know, cool. And that's kind of Peter here. It's like, Peter, I don't remember asking you. You know, Peter just had to, he didn't know what to say, so he had to say something. But notice that it says they were greatly afraid. Peter kind of, you know, pipes up. Let's put up a couple of tents. He forgot the tent for himself and James and John. That's how flabbergasted he is. I'll build three tents and we'll just stand here, I guess, was, you know, Lord. And he didn't know what to say, for they were greatly afraid. Fear in the presence of God is just a reflex. And we see it time and time again, all the way back right after the fall. In the cool of the day, the Lord comes to the garden. And Adam, where are you? Adam says, well, I was afraid. So I hid. He was afraid. When early in the Gospels, you know, Zacharias goes into the Holy of Holies as the high priest that year, Zacharias, who will be the father of John the Baptist, and an angel, Zacharias, you're going to have a son. And says Zacharias was, you know, afraid. When the angel appeared to Mary to announce Jesus, his first words, don't be afraid. Same with Joseph. An angel appears to Joseph in a dream. Joseph, don't be afraid. They were afraid. That first miraculous catch of fish. Remember this? Jesus is walking along the Sea of Galilee. And this is before the disciples were the apostles were the apostles. And Peter's out there fishing and James and John are there with their father Zebedee. And they just come in from fishing and they didn't catch much. And Jesus says, throw the nets over on the right side of the boat or left side, whatever it was. And they're going, hey, you know, we've been out fishing all night. Don't mess with us. It's got, just do it. Just, you know, and so they throw the nets, and you know the story. They catch so many fish, the nets are breaking, and the boat's about to sink, and it says that they were afraid. See, that fear in the presence of the Lord is just a reflex. When Jesus calmed the storm, it says, and they were afraid. When Jesus cast the demons out of the man at Gadara, we read about a few chapters ago, and all the people from the town came out, and they saw it, and it says, they were afraid. So they were greatly afraid. And then, verse 7, a cloud came and overshadowed them. Boy, if they weren't scared already, they are going to be now. A cloud comes, overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son. Hear him. Hear him. See, is Jesus Moses and Elijah? Moses the lawgiver. Elijah the prophet. And the cloud comes. And the voice of the Father says, this is my Son. You know, hear him. Listen to him. Pay attention to what he has to say. See, Moses knew the law. He received the law from the Lord. He developed the law beyond the Ten Commandments into all the Levitical codes and practices. But he never knew grace. Moses knew the law, but he never knew grace. Elijah saw visions and gave prophecies, but he never saw the whole plan. He never saw the big picture. But Jesus, he's the one who put all the pieces together. The law, the desert wanderings, the bronze serpent lifted up to save the people from death. And he said, when I'm lifted up, you know, look to me and you'll be saved from your sin. All the prophecies we looked in Daniel, I think last week, 7, about the Son of Man and all the things that Elijah said about the coming kingdom. Jesus put all the pieces together and he not only understood, but he accomplished them. He's the one that figured it out that only by dying for sin, only by him dying for our sin, could we ever be forgotten? And the Father here is saying, you know, Moses, good work with the law. Elijah, great, great prophecy. But this is my Son, and he gets this. He gets it all. He gets the plan. He gets the big picture. Listen to him. We do well to follow that advice. Verse 8. Suddenly, when they'd looked around, they saw no one anymore, but only Jesus with themselves. Just the four of them again. Now as they came down from the mountain, he commanded them that they should tell no one the things they had seen till the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Through this experience that Jesus had invited Peter and James and John to witness, to be with him in, it was as if he was saying, fellas, you know, this is what the kingdom looks like. I'm opening the curtain and you can peek out of this physical reality and its limitations into the kingdom. This is what the kingdom looked like. And he's teaching them and he's teaching us that there's a reality beyond what our five senses can perceive. And fellas, he says, you just got to peek at it. There's a plan greater than what we can wrap our puny little minds around. And Jesus is saying, I just told you about it. You know, don't tell anybody till the Son of Man has risen from the dead. There's a reality beyond our senses. There's a plan that we don't get. There's a creator, says Jesus, whose love is perfect and selfless. That's how Paul could write in Romans 5:8. But God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Not after we got our act together. Jesus is going, are you ready yet? No, not yet. Okay, I'll wait. Are you still doing that? Are you still talking that way? Okay, I'm not ready yet. No, it's not like that at all. It's like, there I am, just the champion slob of the world. You know? Drug habit, divorce, lonely, selfish, full of self-pity, depressed. My buddy in Nashville, same thing, same story. You, same story, down and out, had it, can't deal with it. And he says, that's the condition we were in when the Lord gave his life for us. But too often, see, just like these guys, we don't get it. Look at verse 10. So they kept this word to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant. What does he mean? We don't get it. We don't understand this. And they asked him, saying, well, why do the scribes say Elijah must come first? Well, were we talking about that? I mean, where'd that come from? Seems like kind of a strange thing to say. He answered and told them, indeed, Elijah is coming first and restores all things. And how's it written concerning the Son of Man? You know, enough about Elijah. Let's get back on track here, fellas. How is it written concerning the Son of Man that he must suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I say to you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they wanted, as it's written of him. See, they're not really changing the subject here. Jesus just said, don't say anything about this until after I rise from the dead. And their first question has to do, well, what about Elijah? And they're not really changing the subject. They're just going with what they know. There was a rabbinic tradition, or maybe still is, for all I know, that Elijah would come exactly 3 days before the Messiah. Elijah the prophet, you know, the actual Elijah, would come and he would stand on the mountain and he would shout, you know, supernaturally so that all the people of Israel could hear. And the first day he'd say, peace comes to the world. Peace comes to the world. And then the next day, the second day, Elijah would get back on the top of the mountain and he'd say, good comes to the world. Good comes to the world. And then on the third day, Elijah would climb back on the mountain and he would say, salvation comes to the world. Salvation comes to the world. Interestingly enough, the word for salvation in Hebrew is Yeshua, which is Jesus. Jesus comes to the world, and then the next day, according to the tradition, the Messiah would come. Now, see, their question is, if you're the Messiah, where's Elijah? You know, if you're here, What happened to the 3 days and all the peace to the world and good to the world? What happened to all that? And Jesus answers, well, Elijah has come, and we've already looked at that. He explained that John the Baptist came in the spirit of Elijah, saying, make a straight path, fill in the potholes and smooth out the bumps in the road, because the Messiah is coming. And then he says, as far as John the Baptist in verse 13, and they did to him whatever they wished. And they did. Pilate. Herod Antipas arrested him, stuck him in a prison, brought him out like a pet monkey once in a while to hear him talk, because he enjoyed having his spiritual funny bone tickled, but he wasn't sincere. And ultimately, you remember the story, had John beheaded. They did to him whatever they wanted to, he says, and then he brings our attention back. And how is it written concerning me, the Son of Man, that he must suffer many things and be treated with contempt? Steering their attention and our attention back to the reality of the kingdom. So, when the kingdom comes, he's told us how to become a part of it. He's given us a peek at it. When the kingdom comes, will you be ready? See, if you've trusted Jesus for life, you will. If you believe that his death on the cross satisfied the consequences for your sin, if you will surrender every area of your life and follow him, you will be. No, you are ready for the kingdom to come. And in fact, you don't have to wait for someday. The kingdom will come to you today, this very morning. All you got to do is turn from your sin, invite Jesus to live his life through you, and receive the forgiveness that he's offering you. And you can do that right now.